It's Security Weekly News, episode 181. How about that? As the year starts rolling by and my controller has stopped again. Oh, there we go. Hang on. I got it. Okay, we're going. All right. Welcome to the week of 23 January 2022. We got Control Web Panel, Russia, Belarus, maybe the Ukraine too. The gang's all here. Office Macros, TrickBot, Mole Rats, DT Packer, Tesla, and Jason Wood on this edition of Security Weekly News.
This is Security Weekly. For security professionals, by security professionals.
We interrupt our program to bring you this important message.
It's the show that keeps you up to date on the latest security news twice a week. Your trusted source for accurate security information and expert analysis. It's time for Security Weekly News.
Monitoring and maintaining compliance is a never-ending struggle with a high price of failure. FireMon helps customers meet complex and varying compliance requirements. FireMon has fully customizable reporting, analytics, assessments, and dashboards to meet the compliance needs of any organization. With FireMon, compliance reports take a tenth of the time, and real-time continuous compliance eliminates the anxiety and headaches of audit preparation. Improve security outcomes by improving security operations with FireMon. Visit securityweekly.com/FireMon to learn more. Every 11 seconds, there's a new ransomware attack. Oil pipelines, universities, corporations, all paying millions of dollars. Barracuda says, don't pay the ransom. Before a ransomware attack occurs, train your teams to recognize an attack and use anti-phishing technology. Protect your applications, and they can't get onto your network. Simple backup and restore solutions quickly recover your data without paying the ransom. Build your ransomware protection plan now by visiting securityweekly.com/Barracuda. That's securityweekly.com/Barracuda.
All right. Security Weekly News. I'm Doug White. There are a couple of flaws, two, in Control Web Panel, which is called CWP. And if you don't know what Control Web Panel is, then it probably doesn't matter that much to you. But a lot of people use this. And what it is it's a web hosting management tool that has over 200,000 subscribers for servers. These two flaws can together allow remote code execution on Linux servers. So here we go with more Linux server attacks. This particular tool used to be called CentOS Web Panel, or CentOS, depending on who you talk to. I always think CentOS sounds like a place in Game of Thrones, and I think that was Pentosh or something like that. But CentOS, I always called it CentOS, but who knows what it's really supposed to be called. I'm sure some of you do, and you will let us know. But anyway, CWP is an open source Linux-based management tool for web hosting environments, and it can run on CentOS, Rocky Linux, Alma Linux, Oracle Linux, and other. You can recompile it for all kinds of things. But Octagon Networks found some vulnerabilities, which are two in particular, a file inclusion vulnerability and a file write bug. So put those two things together and it sounds pretty bad, right? So I can now stick you with a file you didn't want and allow it to be written to the disk. So yeah, those two things can be chained together, and that's how you get remote code execution. Essentially, this particular attack is about fooling the PHP process into accepting a file which does not belong there. So this is this file inclusion problem. And so if you can tell it to include, just like you do a library or a file in C++, and you put an include statement in PHP, it can read a file in, and then if you can get it written, you can execute it and write it to the disk, you've got big problems. So, and that's what happens here. The article does have all the details of that. So if you are using CWP or you want to read more about how this kind of an attack actually works, it's all right there in that article. So Russia is targeting the Ukraine. And on Monday, hacktivists in Belarus claimed that they had infected the railroad system in Belarus. And Belarus, right there, and it was another one of those former Soviet Union bloc countries that is now separate, but they're big buddies with the Russians currently. And so basically this hacktivist group decided they're going to infect the railroad system with ransomware, and they said they would provide a decryption key if the president of Belarus stopped aiding Russian troops. The group was calling itself Cyber Partisans, And they published a statement on Telegram, which called the Belarusian president, Lukashenko, a terrorist, and claimed to have encrypted the bulk of servers, database, and workstation on the train system in Belarus, which would, they hope, slow down and disrupt operations. They had a bunch of stuff about how, you know, we've taken proper safety precautions or whatever to keep people from getting hurt, but they wanted to cause problems and get this. They also called for the release of 50 political prisoners in their manifesto or whatever you want to call that. So it would appear that this is a new tactic for the use of ransomware. According to this article, it was the first case where ransomware was being used for hacktivism. So, you know, there you go. And speaking of Russia, on top of arresting the Reval the Reval guys, I'm going to say it my way, Aaron, the Reval guys have now arrested Andrea Sergeyevich Novak, who is the supposed alleged leader of InFraud. And InFraud is a hacker group in Russia that has reputedly caused more than $560 million worth of damage and losses due to their actions. So the Russian Federal Security Service and, wait for it, U.S. law enforcement worked together on the case to target the stolen payment card and identity theft group. There's nothing wrong with that whole statement because I'm like, wait, what? I thought we were enemies, friends, frenemies. I think it's frenemies, but apparently the law enforcement groups were working together. InFraud was targeted in 2018 as well, and they had pretty much their whole organization got disrupted with the arrest of 36 suspects back then. But last week, four individuals who were big shots in this group were arrested in Russia. So this is sort of the remarkable part of the story, and this included Andrea Novak. The U.S. had been threatening to take some kind of action against threat actors that were being harbored in Russia if Russia did not take some kind of action. So maybe this is the beginning of the end for this sort of Russian amnesty on hackers. I mean, for a long time, the sort of, you know, the story went that if you didn't hack anything in Russia, then they would leave you alone. And so a lot of hacking groups set up shop in Russia. But maybe it's over, or is it? You know, who knows? It's a lot of politics going on over there. One huge threat vector that has been around for years, and I'm always amazed when I see this, but it's the good old Office Macro attack. Now, we all know these, right? I mean, all of us have seen this. It's been going on forever. It'll probably keep going on. As long as there's macros, there's going to be attacks. There are going to be files containing malevolent macros. Microsoft kind of went in for this. This story was about Microsoft going in for an all-inclusive approach and allowed their Office suite to have things built into it, like VBA and XLM. And these particular macro tools allow you to access the sort of Microsoft API, which means you can access address books, you can access system controls, you can do all kinds of stuff with these macros. So, you know, this allows Office to work with all your list or your mailing list or your contacts or your spreadsheets or whatever, and you can access all that stuff. And of course, that very thing that makes it convenient also creates the problem, since, you know, people at work send all sorts of Office file types around. And, you know, if macros are enabled, and lots of people have them enabled because they want to get a file and have it run or whatever. And I used to write these things all the time, and we had macros in them. In fact, we had them where the macro had to run. It was like the startup of it. So it was like an application almost that ran in one of these various tools. But if macros are unable to run, well, you know, it can run malware, or it can exfiltrate your data or whatever. Anyway, Microsoft announced that Excel 4.0 XLM macros will now be disabled by default to try and stop XLM attacks. Now, if you don't know what that means or why I'm laughing about it, they've been phasing this in for a long time. But last year, they seemed to really gotten serious about it, and they've now made it canon, and they're going to disable these macros by default. Now, you can go in and turn this back on with group policy. So they actually created tools for that. But to prevent Excel from running, XLM is now a group policy option that would prevent XLM macros from running, and it turns this off. Understand, though, I think the reason I was laughing, these things are so old that it's amazing that people are still using them, because apparently there are companies still using Excel 4.0 macros, which is literally from 3 decades ago. Excel 5.0 macros were introduced in 1993 using VBA. So they switched all this out and added a different language, Visual Basic, as a back end for their macro language, which a lot of people hated and a lot of people liked. But that's another whole can of security worms that they've not really started talking about yet. But there are people that still allow this stuff to run, and they still use these really old scripts. I mean, you got something that works, and they still got it out there clunking along. But things like TrickBot, ZLoader, QBot, and DryDex have all been found recently being installed using old XLM macros. Back in October 2019, a group policy object was added that would allow admins to block Excel users from opening untrusted Microsoft query files. So this is a step forward in reducing some of these antiquated macro threats, but they're still out there. And they, I guess as long as there's macros, they always will be somewhat of an issue. TrickBot has upped their game by adding multiple layers of defenses on the malware to make it more difficult to detect and analyze. When it's doing things that are not very nice. IBM Trusteer analyzed, I guess it's, today is the day of words I don't know how to say. Trusteer analyzed the most recent code injections that are used by TrickBot, and they found a whole lot of new tweaks had been added to it for this very common piece of malware that gets installed all over the place. TrickBot now has some new server-side injection mechanisms. It has added encrypted communications that are between the command and control server and TrickBot. It added an anti-debug feature, and there are other ways that it's obfuscating and hiding the code that's being injected. Some of the other adaptations included a TrickBot JavaScript downloader, which now uses HTTPS instead of being sent in the clear. So that means that when the injectables are being downloaded, they're all encrypted, which means that it's a lot harder for you to see. And if you recall, a few months ago, we had a lot of stories about, is encryption going to have to be, you're going to have to have a skeleton key so you can look at this stuff. This anti-debug mechanism apparently can detect researchers trying to analyze the code. And then if it does that, it runs a process that I guess it overflows memory. It said overloads memory, but I don't know what they mean by that. I'm presuming it's some kind of overflow, and it causes the browser to crash. So, this was all in the IBM report. The new TrickBot code is also obfuscated by being encoded in Base64. So they do a lot of shuffling of stuff around and then encode it all in Base64, again, to make it very difficult for humans to actually see and or read and or interpret. TrickBot started its life as a banking Trojan back in 2016, but expanded to become one of the main delivery mechanisms for ransomware and all sorts of other malware since that time, and is still today very widely used. Zscaler released information about mole rats, and mole rats is an APT that is Arabic speaking, and it has a history of targeting Palestinian interests, and they apparently have a new campaign. They're using Google Drive, Dropbox, and other services to drop spyware on targets. What they do is they use Dropbox API for their command and control structure, and they have then used Google Drive as a place to host their payloads. So they're leveraging all these current well-known services that are being allowed through firewalls. The latest attack they're doing delivers a malicious piece of software in Arabic language, and it is supposedly related to the Palestinian conflict with Israel. But then once you download and execute it, it's sort of a macro again. It basically runs a PowerShell command and downloads malware onto your local machine. And when you click that old enable content button that's sitting there saying, would you like to see this? Once it runs, it opens a listening port and downloads additional materials from that Dropbox folder. So Proofpoint researchers found a new malware downloader in the same ilk called DT Packer, which has a fixed password that involves the former United States President Donald Trump, which is where they came up with the name. So DT Packer. The campaign in particular used a fake Liverpool football club site to lure users to download the malware, which immediately then downloads Agent Tesla. But it also has been found using Ave Maria, Async Rat, Formbook and other malware and that are all being spread by this particular downloader. Proofpoint said that from March 2021, numerous samples were obtained from websites that used soccer or football, depending on which side of the ocean you're on, soccer or football clubs that were faked. So they were setting up a lot of sites like this. DT Packer in particular delivers embedded payloads, hence the name Packer, and it can also download other content from a command and control server, so it's a fairly sophisticated piece of Packer software. The second stage of this malware includes a fixed password for decoding. I guess it's for decoding when it's packed, it gets all shuffled around using some kind of obfuscation, and then you need a password to decode it. But they hard-coded the password into it, and it references the former president. All this Packer-type malware, you know, basically embeds its files so they don't typically download things, but they can. There appears to be no other political motive with this malware other than it uses Trump 2020 as a password, and then later it shifted last August, apparently, to using the password Trump 2026 for all their decoding method. Proofpoint believes this malware will be widely spread in the future. And so, as a child star, he played Lil Dobbin in the hit BBC series Westbury on Severn, but when the series ended, his life took a series of darker turns, which led to something called a Muppet sex tape, the seizure of hundreds of erotic balloon animals, and a lifetime ban from Mexican national television. But he found his way back to the light side through the use of hallucinogens and grape soda. Please welcome Jason Wood.
Hey, Doug, good to be back with you again, and don't knock the ketamine stuff until you try it. Sorry. Actually, not sorry. Regardless. So today's story that I focused in on actually comes from one of my favorite sources of information and general snark about things happening in the UK, the Register. They published a story today that really kind of caught my attention around regulations that are being tossed around in the UK. And I stopped and thought about this a little bit because I've had other conversations with folks about similar concerns, here in the US or in other countries. And basically what's going on, it looks like the UK government appears to be planning, or is at least proposing the idea of passing some laws that are going to require people who work in InfoSec or cybersecurity or whatever you want to call it, to register and I guess go through some kind of licensing process so that they can be authorized to work in the InfoSec field. And the analogy that the Register made was this would be like the General Medical Council that the UK has, where doctors are licensed to practice medicine in the United Kingdom. Now, whatever this council is, they're going to be responsible or would be responsible for setting up standards and, I guess, ethical requirements and whatnot to be able to work in InfoSec, and could even have the impact of, hey, you've screwed up too badly. You lost your license and therefore you're out of work completely. Now, they referenced a council here that I talked about, if I remember right, in a previous episode called the UK Cybersecurity Council. This was supposed to be some kind of in-between council tied to the government, but not entirely mandate, like passing things via legislation that was supposed to set security standards and practices for the United Kingdom, make these some kind of official requirements. And one of the reasons why I remember this group and the mention of it is because they launched and they included in their press release and posts about it a link to their website that actually wasn't their website. It went off to somewhere else. So that little bit stuck out to me. Anyhow, the UK government is apparently not happy with the progress that this council has made, or rather has not made. And so they're pushing out on their own. And so they've kind of put this out here as this is something they're considering. It sounds very early stage. Actually, as I'm looking at the article and some of the links to different articles, it's really pretty thin on information. But still, basically it's laying out the idea that, hey, you have to register if you want to be in InfoSec. If you're not registered and you're working in security, basically, you don't get any kind of legal protections or whatever that may come with being a registered practitioner. So let's say you're a pen tester and you're not registered with this council, Therefore, you don't get any defenses because you're hacking somebody, and even though it was under contract or what have you. I'm not sure if it would play out that way or not, but that's kind of like me doing a hypothetical here. Is it a good idea to have some kind of licensing in InfoSec to work in the field? I'll be honest, my first reaction isn't terribly positive, but there are lots of examples of other fields that require, you know, some kind of licensing and testing and registration with the government. Licensed contractors, you know, building contractors, electricians, pilots, obviously the medical doctors, lawyers, they all have different ways that this is handled. You know, lawyers in particular, they came up with their own system, and that's where you have the bar, where they go through and test and license attorneys to practice law, and that's been okayed by the government. But you know, electricians, for example, they have to go and take a test with their, you know, the local, with your state or whatnot, and then get a license to do their jobs. So, like I said, I'm not sure I like this idea. It's probably just me being contrary. It's something that's come up in the past around security. I remember Kevin Johnson over at Secure Ideas gave a talk at DerbyCon a number of years back. I can't remember which year, but he laid out his thoughts on, hey, at some point, the government's going to come in here and say, we need to have some standards and we're going to enforce them on you. And he was proposing, hey, let's work on doing this ourselves, so that we can, you know, like the bar point, no, here's what we're doing and the whole bit, and try and get the government to buy off on that. Obviously, nothing's really happened in that regards towards his idea there. But, you know, it is kind of, you know, who's going to make up these standards? What does it mean? You know, you've got to do X, Y, and Z, and it's mandated by government. Well, what if the attackers are doing something that makes that a real problem? How long, you know, you know, the practice is outdated and there's weaknesses around it, but you still got to do it. Otherwise you lose your license to have a job. It's kind of things that I get concerned about. Obviously, you know, you'd have organizations like ISE squared to be like, hey, we'll come up with a certification for this. I mean, they already talk about the having their code of conduct and ethics and whatnot, along with their assessments. So they'll come up, maybe they would come up with something like the certified information security technician, or I don't know, whatever. One thing I wondered about as I was reading this, would the legislation have any impact if it was enacted in the UK? Would it have any impact on anybody in the United States or in any other countries? And I would say, well, no, I don't live there, so it doesn't matter. But we could also see where, you know, GDPR was rolled out, for example, and it still ends up having an impact around the world because of, you know, people in the UK or the EU rather using sites that are in the United States or France or, I don't know, Australia or something like that. Anyhow, you know, there could be some implications around this. I work on a team right where we're spread around the world, and I have counterparts in the UK. So if they were required to be registered, would my employer look at me and say, well, you know, they have to meet these requirements. So to be fair, you've got to meet these requirements too. And it kind of rolls out that way. I don't know. I'm just kind of floating out some ideas here. Obviously, I can't say what would happen, but attorneys, lawyers, and the politicians would definitely have opinions on this. It'll be interesting to see how this turns out, if it turns out. I'm always kind of watching to see what governments are doing and how they make requirements on practices and way things are done in technology and in security. So is this just going to be just something that they're talking about, or is this going to actually get some traction and we're going to start seeing some legislation being passed or being at least proposed formally in the United Kingdom? I don't know. We'll have to watch and see. I'm sure there'll be lots of talk about it if it does come out, because it's going to have a, you know, pretty big impact, certainly to anybody in InfoSec who lives in the UK. If you want to go check out the article, go ahead and take a look in the show notes. It's got the link to the register, and you can follow that to all the other various links that they found on this topic. So go ahead and check it out.
Thanks, Jason. I'm actually going to use my time now to talk about that as well. That's a very interesting thing, because I have a PI license because of that. Back in the day, in the early part of the 21st century,
forensics.
Yeah. So there was a whole discussion that popped up because states started passing laws about digital forensics and requiring people to be private investigators. And most of the states, and I am a co-author on the famous or infamous Lenardo paper, which tracks the PI law requirements state to state in the United States. And it was a lot of controversy about this because states like Texas and Massachusetts required PI licenses to do digital forensics work there. But the requirements they used for this were set by their private investigator boards. And most of those were targeted for ex-law enforcement people. So a lot of the states require, Massachusetts in particular, required a whole series of steps in a law enforcement career in order to be a private investigator just to get a license. And I went out because in Rhode Island, the requirement was that the local police chief had to endorse you. So I called Paul and said, not our Paul, but it was a different Paul. And I said, hey, Paul, can you approve me for a PI license? And I went and got one. And it was a lot of controversy about this. And, you know, in the United States anyway, federal law, there was never, some people didn't agree with me on this, but I said there would never be a federal licensure of forensicators because there's no federal licensing of anything. There's no federal licensing of doctors, lawyers, accountants, or any of those kind of things because it's very difficult. And it would have to be a state by state kind of thing. And that's where that sits today. There are states that specifically do say that you have to have a PI license to do digital forensics and you have to be bonded and all these kind of things. And there's states that say you don't. Like Rhode Island doesn't require it, but Massachusetts does. So if I want to go work in Massachusetts as a forensicator, I'm required to hire a private investigator who's licensed in the state of Massachusetts to supervise me and ensure that I don't break the law. And I found that to be very onerous. But I mean, it may be coming, you know, insurance, licensing, and all those things kind of pop up to be there and to end up being requirements. It's a very interesting topic. I may talk about it on Friday in my commentary because I saw that story as well, and I was very, very interested in that and where that might lead for pen testing and or all sorts of cybersecurity stuff. Because like you said, it's a huge issue when we get down to the nuts and bolts of it, and we've got legislators who don't really understand the industry trying to write laws based on whoever has the most money. Like I went and spoke at the North Carolina Private Investigator annual meeting where a room full of guys, and it was all guys, sat in the back room of a resort and were making decisions about this stuff that would then be imposed by the state. And they were all private investigators. There was no one there that had any inkling of what digital forensics was. They were all traditional private investigators who go out and do skip tracing and all this kind of stuff. None of them had a clue, and they did not want to hear from us because they wanted to control that industry as well. And, you know, basically what they did was they passed rules that said I would have to pay one of them to supervise me just like I do in Massachusetts. So if I go work in Massachusetts, I had to hire a PI who basically sat down at the coffee shop and said, call me when you're done, that had no idea what I was actually doing. They were just supposed to make sure I wasn't violating some kind of, I don't know, privacy rules or whatever. So it's a very interesting topic. Thanks, Jason. I had to put my two cents in. And that is the news. Thank you, Jason. And I will see everybody on Friday on the wrap-up show. And my crew's going to string me up because I changed the format there on the fly. But, you know, that's how it goes sometimes.